everyone. Welcome back to Patriot to the Core podcast. I really appreciate you tuning in and listening to us here in season one. Hopefully you've enjoyed the variety of guests that we've had these last, these first few weeks, I guess, of the podcast. Before we get to Major Will Lyles, I would ask that you please go to iTunes and rate us. Give it an honest rating. Hopefully it's a 5-star. But anyway, just to help, hopefully we can get some good positive ratings so we can, move to the tops of the searches when people are looking for some motivational, inspiring, and patriotic podcasts, that type of thing. But anyway, we'll get here to talking to Will. Will retired as a major from the Army. He actually was a member of the Special Forces, which is also known as a Green Beret. And he's going to talk about, how he prepared to even become a member of the Special Forces, and then some of his deployments. Then, the focal point really is how he dealt with his injuries from 2010. He actually was hit by an IED, which really jacked up his legs. He lost both of his legs above the knee, and also caused some death to some of his teammates. And so I really want to kind of get into how he dealt with that mentally and emotionally and then physically to overcome the trial, because he's had to really change some things up in his lifestyle now. And then it also, I know it really affected his family and his kids. It was hard on his kids to see him like that, because Will played baseball in college on scholarship, so he was talented. And he was also in good shape physically, and he's tall, about 6'3". So it's a really big change for him, and I really applaud him for just serving our country voluntarily after he graduated college even. So I'm looking forward to bringing him in. Well, Major Will Lyles, it's great to have you on my show. I appreciate you joining Patriot to the Core, and after a long day's travel, thanks for being willing to spend some time with me.
No, it's an honor. You guys are an amazing family. It's an honor. It's the least I could do. And I'm looking forward to doing this talk with you today.
Well, good. I think that you could probably help a lot of people with what you've experienced and what you've overcome. And just to get to where you are in the military, or where you were before you retired as Special Forces or a Green Beret. And I guess just to make sure I speak correct lingo, I try to be very, maybe I'm kind of anal about it too, but I want to be accurate. The official term is Special Forces, is that right?
Yes, sir. Green Beret is Special Forces. I mean, it's the same thing, but that is the correct term.
Okay.
How to use it. I mean, people get confused and they lump it all together, but everybody has their kind of distinct mission sets and stuff like that. But I am a Green Beret, or U.S. or Army Special Forces.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't learn that until after Mark's death, and my brother taught me. So I've tried to be accurate ever since. But why don't you go ahead and – well, I know, first of all, you got your bachelor's degree. So, why did you do that? What did you get it in? And then, why did you choose that before you entered the Army?
To be perfectly honest, college wasn't really an option in my household. My dad told me you either go to college or once you hit 18, you're out of the house. So it was kind of just something that my parents encouraged and I would say pushed. But I mean, it was something I wanted to do, just kind of broaden my horizons and get smarter, I guess. Fortunately enough, I actually went to college on a baseball scholarship. So that was always the plan, to go to school, get my bachelor's degree. To be honest, too, I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I got there. I bounced around a couple majors. I did graduate on time in 4 years. I played varsity sports all 4 years. Ended up graduating with a degree, a bachelor's in psychology with minors in philosophy and leadership studies. Psychology really spoke to me. I enjoy people. I enjoy working with people, understanding how people think. The one thing that stands out to me is I had to write a thesis for a minor. Wrote a paper, one, you know, probably not an in-depth thesis that people do for master's degrees or a doctorate or something, but I wrote a thesis on what is the or best coaching style or management style that somebody can have. And the thing that I learned is that there is no correct or best managing style. Everybody's different. And the best management style is actually figuring out what motivates that individual and trying to encourage them or motivate them in that manner on what drives them, what makes them want to tick or work, however you want to put it, accomplish that mission. So that was kind of like a big takeaway. I really enjoyed psychology. I went to a military college. Even it's a state school, no requirement to go in the military, but probably one of the best decisions I've ever made. It didn't seem like that at the time, but when it was all said and done, I was glad I did it.
So you, at what point did you decide to join the Army?
A year after I graduated. You know, to be honest with you, I was kind of bouncing around from job to job. I was working at a small aviation firm back home in Virginia. Not really sure what I wanted to do. I had a I had a 2-year-old daughter at the time, and I had a young daughter that was just born. And just, I mean, honestly, I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself, and decided I'd give this Army a try. Like, I thought it sounded like it'd be a good career, but I really wasn't sure. I love Virginia. I liked my bubble. I did not like to leave my bubble. And home was, it was home. All my friends and family were there. So it was kind of stepping out on a limb and kind of doing something different. And even though going to a military school, that's kind of what kept me, like, that career. Like, I just wanted to be home. I liked the same things. I did the same things all the time. I hung out with the same friends and really did not like to venture out on my own. So the Army was a big step and kind of a leap into the unknown, per se. But turns out it's the best thing I've ever done in my life. You know, basic training and then moving on to officer candidate school and airborne and ranger school. And I had a degree, but once you, and I had 4 years ROTC, but once you graduate, they can't do anything for you. So I had to go to officer candidate school. So I went from basic training to officer candidate school, and I was selected, or I was, you don't really select your branch. You can list your top choices, and I select infantry was my number two choice, and that's what I got. And like I said, it's kind of one of the best things that's ever happened to me. Sometimes you don't pick your career picks you. And like I said, I can I tell people all the time, the Army gave to me more than I gave to it. And I learned a lot about myself, about being an effective leader. Most importantly, probably is a lot more confidence than I ever had, the ability to stand up in front of people and just be a good leader. And don't ask people to do things that you're not willing to do. Don't be the first guy in the door in the morning and the last to leave if you're a leader. That's just, I learned a lot of life lessons in my time, and I'm so grateful for it. Even being wounded and losing my legs, I wouldn't trade it for anything. You meet so many guys, and I'm just extremely lucky.
Well, how were you physically with basic training and the demands on your body when you entered? How did you handle all that and compare to the others?
You know, honestly, like, probably a little better than most. I mean, all my life I've been a really good athlete. I mean, I won't say I've been in, like, tip-top shape all my life, but I've been in decent shape to start off with. But I liked the physical challenge. That's another thing that I liked about the Army, was just the physicalness of the job. Being a combat soldier, being an infantry soldier, it requires, there's a lot of physical challenges, long ruck marches with heavy weight. And, you know, the Lord blessed me with a, you know, a pretty good sized frame, and being 6'3", 6'4", you know, 200 plus pounds, that, you know, I can, yeah. I guess for your military tasks and the things that we were asked to do physically, I had the frame to do it. And like I said, I probably wasn't, you know, wasn't in great shape when I left, but I got there, and I, you know, in the infantry or special forces, it's vital that you are in the best shape, because when you're a leader, if your soldiers beat you, you never hear the end of it. So you make sure that you try to lead the way in every task as much as possible.
So how much of it would you say was mental?
I think a lot of it's mental. I mean, it's, you know, growing up, and that's one thing that I was glad that my parents really instilled us. Whatever we did, we were never allowed to quit anything. That was stressed. If I started playing a sport, if I said I wanted to do some kind of instrument lesson, which, you know, wasn't my forte exactly, but I mean, you know, if I wanted to go, you know, do wrestling, like I wrestled once in JV, never wrestled in my life, never got on the mat, but I wanted to do it. And not that I ever wanted to quit, but my dad was always like, if you start something, you will finish it. There's no quitting. Even if you don't like it, you'll finish out the season. But that was one thing that our parents really instilled in us. And I think I took that a lot into the Army, be it Ranger School or Airborne. Like, even if you give it your all, and maybe you don't make it, maybe you don't get selected or you don't make it through, but that you can look yourself in the mirror at the end of the day and say, you know, I gave it everything I had and I didn't quit. So that, I think mentally, that's what it is. Like, it's a grind. I mean, every school, it's all tests all the time. And I mean, some mental, some physical, some's just combat stress related in the situations you're put in, and you're being a leader and they're putting you in positions that you're going to fail. I mean, there's no, you know, it's almost impossible. I mean, for a young guy who doesn't know what he's doing, and you're going to fail, but it's how you take it and move on. And again, that's something else my parents really pushed on us as kids, is how to deal with adversity. And when you don't fail, how do you respond to it? When you fail, how do you respond to it? You know, so what if this happens? What are you going to do now? How are you going to make it better the next time? How are you not going to let this happen again? So it is a mental grind. I think anybody should, if you show up to the military and you're not in good shape and you don't make it, then that's your problem. You know, I don't know how else to put that. I mean, that's the job. That's part of the job. That's mandatory. So everybody should be in shape in the military. I mean, theoretically, everybody should. Doesn't always happen, but it's the mental part. You know, I've seen good guys that just quit on themselves, or they quit on others just because they can't deal. And I think just part of it is my upbringing. Part of it is the training. And, you know, based on all the things I've seen and done, and by all means, I'm not tooting my horn. I don't know why I'm able to deal with things the way I am. I don't really have a good answer for that. But I think it's all kind of like all that stuff combined.
So I'm wondering about your mindset a little bit. I mean, did you have a plan if you didn't make it in SF, or did you just, was it always, there's no doubt I'm going to make it?
I mean, I doubt myself, you know, something about myself too, about being confident. I won't say I'm that confident in myself. I mean, there's always that self doubt. And I think everybody has that doubt when you're going through the Q course and you got this test and that test, it's always in the back of your mind, but there really isn't an option. I guess I always was going to, you know, once it happens and you don't make it, then you go from there. But until that time, you really don't consider it that much what's going to happen afterwards. I never felt like I wasn't like in there. You just got to give it your best. And I felt like if I gave it my best and I was standing at the end, that things would hopefully be all right. And just putting my best foot forward. I don't ever think that I think I never really gave any thought to what would happen if I didn't make it.
Okay. Well, so what was the hardest part or section of the, you know, and the combat controllers call it the pipeline.
Yeah.
What do you call it in SF?
The SF pipeline, or just in the course. I think there's tough aspects all of it. I just think it's a mental grind. Like, I mean, the course is not short. I mean, you're depending on your language and kind of, you know, you got different parts of it. There's the language training, and then there's small unit tactics, which kind of gets everybody, because anybody can go to special forces. You don't have to be on combat arms, but it kind of gets everybody on the same page on working in a small unit on different responsibilities and how it all works in different combat situations. SEER school, learning your, you know, whatever your job is. I was in the Alpha course as an officer. I'm an Alpha, 18 Alpha. That's our MOS. So I was in the Alpha course. And then Robin Sage, you have to take everything you've learned over the entire year, year and a half, and put it all together and work with the team. And they kind of just, they assess everybody, and that's a month long. And I mean, the pipeline itself is between a year, year and a half, depending on your language. And they tweak it and change it all the time. So, it, you know, there are some changes that, but in general, it's just a mental grind. Because there's so many tests, you're always being evaluated, you're always on guard. I mean, it's you're working with, you know, obviously in special forces, everybody, you know, most people are type A personalities. Some get along with others. It's, I mean, every, you know, for the most part, the guys in the Corps, everybody's good people and you're working, but still there's strong personalities. And like I said, you're always being evaluated. They're always watching, and you got to be the best. I think everybody feels that pressure. Everybody shooting for a Green Beret is probably type A and wants to be the best at whatever they do. And you're competing against everybody else. I mean, everybody's going for the same goal and you're in it together, but you're also competing against each other as well to kind of, you know, make it through. And you got to work together. But, you know, like I said, sometimes you have to, not everybody's going to be having a good day on that day. So some people are going to have to pick up the slack for the other people and so on. So it's just kind of, it's a team effort, but it's also competitive at the same time. And I just don't know how to explain it. It just, when you're always being evaluated, somebody's always watching you. You're having tests all the time. You're not getting a lot of sleep, depending on what's going on, that it just, it wears on you. It's a marathon, not a sprint, as they say. So it sounds cliche, but it's true.
Well, I was talking to another one of Mark's teammates, SF, and you probably know him. And actually, I don't know if you do. But anyway, I asked him about going through this several years ago. And he said, you know, it was all of a sudden I made it. You know, I was trying to get to this point. So, well, let me get to this point. And then it's just, bam, okay. I just overcame everything and succeeded. But so it was I don't know. I don't know if he ever looked long term or not. That he was doing a little bit at a time, short term thinking, and he made it. And I mean, I imagine he was successful too.
That's kind of, I mean, everybody, like, you think long term, but it's like, I just got to make it to this. I just got to make it through this. Like, this portion of pipeline, you make it to the end of this portion, and then you start worrying about, you know, getting through the next portion. And that's exactly how it is. You're just trying to make it to the next, through this portion, through SEER school. I got to make it through this however many weeks. And then SUT, I got to make it through this field problem. And, you know, but you're still waiting around, waiting to see if you hear your name called, like, or, you know, for bad or for good. And it's stressful. I mean, nobody wants to be that guy that fails. And it's a nervous wreck at times.
Were you married going through that?
I was married. My daughter was actually, my youngest daughter was born 3 weeks before I started. Like, I had gone through selection and I got selected, and then I was starting the Q course, and my daughter was born, and 3 weeks later I left to go to the field. And I was gone between these two parts of the course. I was essentially gone for, I think it was 3 months total. I mean, I came home once or twice, like, got like a little break in between. And so I saw her then, but my youngest daughter, and I have four kids. I was married before. So I was married back 6 months after I got out of college, not even six. It was, about 4 or 5 months after I got graduated college. And then I got my ex-wife and I split up about 2 years after I was injured, kind of jumping ahead with that one. But I actually just got remarried a little over a year ago. But I was married to my first wife at that point. We have four kids. They now are 16, 13, 9, and I got one boy out of those four. So let's just say I got a bunch of gray hairs coming in now.
Well, I think you've got a little athlete, don't you? I'm pretty sure I saw something about your boy at least a few years ago in some sporting events.
Yeah, he's really, you know, my 16-year-old, she's more of a she's really into church and fashion and, you know, things that I don't know, you know, as far as the fashion. I call her a little fashionista. She's not so little anymore, but she's really into fashion and really into church and volunteering with the church. So she's not much of a sports, but the other three, they're all about sports. My 13-year-old, she was into soccer for a long time, but she switched over to basketball. She played basketball for the middle school. And my 9-year-old, he does it. You know, he's all in the football. He's like every other, you know, little boy out there. He loves every sport known to man. And one thing that I took up after being injured was hunting. I started hunting. Never hunted before at all until I was injured. But I'm hooked. I'm matter of fact, it's about 90 days until bow season gets going. So, but he's a little hunter now, and we get out and we hunt together. At least try to once a year. He got his first buck a couple years ago, and he was super pumped and got out with him last year. We just didn't get a good shot on anything for him. And my youngest, Gabby, she loves, you know, T-ball, and she's only six, so she's still feeling it out. But she's into gymnastics and softball and soccer. So I think definitely my kids probably inherited my love for sports because they're all into something. And even though, you know, they live in San Antonio, but they're here for the summer. And I spend a lot of time with them. I definitely do a lot of driving between here in the Woodlands and San Antonio. So I stay pretty active with them, and they definitely keep me on my toes. And I love spending time with them.
Yeah, it's good they stay active. That's what I hope. I hope my kids are the same way. They are right now anyway.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your deployments. I mean, how many deployments did you have? Can you say, you know, maybe some idea of, give us an idea of where all you went?
So I've got three deployments total, two to Iraq, one to Afghanistan. My two deployments to Iraq was as an infantry officer with the 3rd Infantry Division. Deployed first time, ended up being a platoon leader. I was an infantry platoon leader. And then that was in January 05 to January 06. And then we came back from that deployment, refitted, trained up, redeployed back to Iraq as part of the surge in April 2007. I got back late. I deployed in April 07 as a company XO executive officer, me second in command of a 120-man infantry company, and deployed in April 07, came back late June of 2008, and I had applied before that deployment to go to Special Forces. As an officer, you can't apply. Like, you can't just say, hey, I want to do this. You have to apply. Once you are first lieutenant promotable or junior captain, you can apply whenever they open up your year group. You apply to go to Special Forces. I was selected to ascend. You're selected to attend selection. Nobody, not just everybody gets a chance to go. Came back from that deployment, went to the captain's career course, then went to selection after captain's career course was over. And normally you would go to selection before captain's career course, but because of deployment and when I got promoted to captain just before my second deployment. And just the way that whole thing, I was pretty, for a captain, is pretty, I guess, senior to be where I was at that point in time. I needed to get to the captain career course. So I went there first and then selection. Finished up selection, went through the Q course. Finished up the Q course, and I think I graduated April 3rd, 2010, and then deployed to Afghanistan July 5th. Iraq is different than Afghanistan. I just want to make that distinction. Iraq is, I tell people, just a whole different animal. Iraq is very, I won't say very, but they are westernized. They have a central government. So, like, I won't say strong, but I mean, they have a central government. They've always had a strong central government. And it's very, they have a lot of infrastructure in place. And depending on where, and, you know, somebody might tell you something different, but where I've been in Afghanistan was very rural. There's no electricity, no running water, no internet. You know, if one village wants to talk to the next or somebody wants to talk, it's by Motorola radio from the top of a mountain to another. Just very, very different, very. Iraq, I'd seen both sides of the spectrum in 05 in Sadr City, which is in Baghdad. It's, just, you know, a slum in Sadr, you know, a slum, you know, very neglected by Saddam, where, you know, because the people were Shiites there and they had had an uprising in the years prior. And he just, you know, I saw what being poor truly is, and I've never seen anything like that. Just raw sewage in the street, people sleeping in filth. And I mean, I just, you know, we have that in the States, but I would struggle to say we have it to that. I mean, there are some poor areas here in the States, but I mean, what I saw there was, mm-hmm. It was different. It was just different. And then 07, 08, it was part of the surge. We went into an area that hadn't seen coalition forces in over a year. And it was rough. I mean, we had 13 killed in action in the first 90 days of that deployment for my battalion. It wasn't just my company, but also out of those 13, seven of those guys were from my former platoon. You know, when you get promoted and you move up to a different position, seven of those guys that got killed out of that 13 were my former soldiers and just young kids. Didn't know anybody. I mean, some of them were young kids who hadn't first deployment and know what they were getting themselves into. And I mean, not that bad. I mean, they saw them grow up. I mean, they've been through a lot in that short period of time. And that kind of, I think that deployment was rough. It showed a lot. But I mean, I saw the change. Like in the surge, you saw where we were just under constant attack. And then we made, you know, we were living with the people and, you know, amongst them, and we had a constant presence. And the last 6 months of that 15, 16 months, we didn't have a single attack. And we saw that transition throughout the whole country. And it was kind of fulfilling and it was good to see. And you know, people began to trust in us. And, you know, you saw the country change and it was a phenomenal experience. It was a phenomenal to be a part of. And you saw this battlefield successes. And I don't mean just, you know, war is a rough thing. But you saw the good, the schools built, the medical side that people don't show on the news, where you're building schools and you're pumping money and we fixed water pumps and people were able to farm again because the terrorists were breaking. You know, the second time I was in the country, what the terrorists had done was break the water pumps, and it was a mainly agriculture area. So the people couldn't farm and they made the people dependent on doing attacks on coalition forces and that kind of thing. And, you know, we were able to change the face of the fight there and really get people on board and saw that we were trying to help them. And that's hard. You know, it's not always easy getting buy-in from people who, you know, maybe they've had bad experience or maybe they just don't understand, you know, that you're there to help and you're trying to explain it. I mean, that kind of changed my mind frame a lot. And you got to see the transition where in 05, it was a lot of politics involved and a lot of just destruction, but not necessarily, and you're trying to do good, but maybe it didn't always work out. But we definitely, during the surge, and you saw it, like the drop in attacks was insane. I mean, there was still stuff going on, but compared to what it was where, I mean, literally, you know, I wasn't at the, we were at the Big Fob for a short period of time before we went out and built a patrol base. But I mean, there was so many killed and wounded, not just from our unit, but just the number of units that were at Fob Falcon. There was probably, we do combo blackouts when people are injured, so the family's notified in a proper manner. That's the thought. And I mean, the phone was locked up for a couple months straight, and I'm not exaggerating. That was like, in one time, as soon as they turned it on, and I just happened to, as a company XO, you do supply and logistics. I mean, that's kind of your you know, your thing, you're keeping your company running, and that's kind of take that off their commander's shoulder. And I happened to go back to the base, and literally as soon as they unlocked it, 2 seconds later, they had to lock it right back up. And it was just, it's hard to see. And I mean, I know, you know, I don't have to tell you how tough that is to get that call. It's hard to see. It's hard to see your buddies getting injured. And it's, but I mean, I also think that all those things that I saw and done gave me more of an appreciation for what we have here, what this country is all about. And, you know, it's you, when you've been in the fight, and you know, I listen to the national anthem, and I mean, I'm a sports fanatic, and it just, it chokes me up. I mean, I'm proud to be where I am, and I'm proud of this country. Sometimes, you know, today it's a tough day. Days like today are tough. You know, you read the news and you see all the bad, but there's a lot of good being done in the world. And yeah, so that's that. And then Afghanistan, again, whole different animal. You know, where Mark and I were, it's at that point in time, it was only accessible by helicopter. We didn't have a lot of info. You know, for us, things were changing. It was very, you know, fluid as far as where we were going. I think I learned the fire base we were going to the day of, or maybe the day before we left. Didn't know a lot about it. Didn't have a lot of time to figure out what was going on, and maybe wasn't a day, it might have been a week. It was a short time though, comparatively. Like usually you would go check out, you know, a couple people would go over, check, get briefed, like check out, do a reconnaissance, you know, ADVON, whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it, to just kind of see what you're going into, how's things working on the ground, just talk to the guys and maybe go out and see what it's like. And then you go back and talk to everybody and kind of – that's normally how it goes, but this time was very fluid. Again, they were doing more of a surge, have you, into Afghanistan, trying to get into places and get more of that presence and do this village stability where they – you know, you live with the people, and that's how you build the trust, and you live with the people when you just – by being there, it's kind of – Green Berets were trying to get back to what Green Berets do. Just with the wars, everybody's kind of lumped into doing one thing, and we were trying to get back to by, with, and through. I mean, that's how you work yourself out of a job. You work with the locals and get them to do, because they're going to be there long after you're going to be there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, big part of our job is trying to get them up to speed and trying to just work with them. And it was rough. I mean, it's a rough area. It's a huge enemy presence, and people aren't very receptive to what you're trying to do. Or not everybody. I won't say everybody, but I mean, there are some that are, you know, really against you. I've been through some tough meetings, and sometimes it's hard to get buy-in to what you're selling. I mean, you're not really selling, but you are selling something. You're selling, you know, and when you're going to an area that maybe they don't understand everything going on, it's hard to sell them on something that they can't possibly imagine or understand, just because, you know, he's just trying to live his life and get by day to day. Can't really fathom, you know, strong central, mm-hmm. you know, government, or he just doesn't get it and he doesn't understand. You're trying hard to get him to understand on maybe having a different vision possibly or something, and tell him.
How did you interact with the village elders and build the relationships that you did with them?
You try to be upfront and showing respect, and also, like, I mean, they're like anybody else. I mean, you just try to get buy-in and try to show them. We did. I know you've met Captain Wes Wilson, or Major Wes mm-hmm. Wilson. Now he's a good friend of mine, and we've actually been friends my entire Army career. Kind of funny how that happened, but we went through infantry officer basic course together, and you know, we just tried to show the people that we cared. We did several lunches and dinners, try to build that camaraderie and kind of talk to them and mentor them, get them out there, from the leaders and the, you know, the district leaders to the village elders, getting them out, talking to the people, and trying to, I think it's important that you don't do everything for them, that you try to get them to, like, motivate them to do it, but assist them and kind of give them a gentle nudge per se, and just kind of get them to think. I don't know. There's no real good reason. I think you have to analyze too. Again, it kind of goes back to that college thing. Like, what's their motivation? What are their goals? I mean, for them, it is about survival. I mean, they're trying to get through on a day to day, but we're trying to spend more time with the people and get out there with them. Cause it's hard, like, for them to be, maybe they don't feel like they can defend themselves, but I can't always be there. So it's up to them to kind of secure themselves sometimes. I don't know how to really explain that per se, but it's just trying to talk to them, motivate them, be there, like, listen to their grievances, talk to them like they're on your same level, but also analyzing them to also see what their motivations are. Maybe they are, sometimes, for the most part, there are good people out there, but sometimes they're bad guys that are also trying to work you over, and you got to be able to know when that's happening. And maybe he's playing both sides of the fence, and I'm not saying that's all the time, but that does happen for sure. And you just have to be aware of that, and always be thinking and trying to see, people say hearts and minds, and it is about hearts and minds. You get more, out of when you kill people all the time, or you do, you hurt somebody's family member. It's necessary, Tom. It's an unfortunate part of war. I mean, there is enemy out there, but you also got to follow that up with good things for the people so that they see it's not all bad, that you are trying to help. I mean, it's kind of walking that fine line, and it's tough sometimes to really know. Sometimes there really is maybe not a right answer. You got to do the best you can and make the best decision you can, and it's not always easy, and it's tough, and sometimes you sit back and you say, well, I should have done this, or I should have done that, but sometimes it's hindsight 2020. But I mean, it's just through meetings, mentorship, constructive criticism, but it's a lot like here, where some people, when you yell at them or you're on top of them, they just crumble. But if you give them some space, they'll flourish. Or maybe you have to find that kind of, like I said, that middle ground where maybe it's you are stern, but you're also, you play both sides of the card. I mean, I don't think there's any right answer on how you do that, but that's just as far as actual things. It's just meetings there. You're trying to put money into the local economy through schools and trying to employ people for road projects and, get it going. I mean, I think a lot of it is just a lot of people there care about day to day. I mean, it's like everybody else here in the States. If life's not easy, you're in a daily struggle trying to feed your family and get by. That's what you care about, and you're going to do what you need to do in order to feed your family. I'm much like that. I mean, that's kind of, truth be told, that's kind of how I ended up in the military, was just trying to take care of my family. I was getting into, and then, that's what, in general, they care about is just day to day, get through, like, feed my family. I want to, it's important. And I think that's one need that I don't care where you're from. Your family is the most important thing to you, and you're going to do what you need to do to take care of them.
Do you think that most of the, and by the way, we had a bad connection and you cut out for just a couple seconds, right? When you were saying, that's kind of the reason why you joined the military is to feed your family, I think. And you cut out just for like two or three seconds, probably right there. But
I tell everybody that, for me, like, I'll be really honest, it wasn't because of 9/11 or anything like that. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't, I had two girls, and I was working, my job was decent, but I was working 70, 80 hours just to make ends meet. And, I can't complain about what I was doing, but at the same time, I had to do something different. There was something better out there, something that I can do more with. And, that's kind of how I had to do better at that time. That was just my two girls. My son was born after about nine to 10 months after my first deployment. And, close to a year after my first, after I returned from my first deployment. And, my daughter was born after my second, a year after my second. So it's, you know, to me, family's important. I think that's for the way it is for a lot of folks. And I think for the average Afghan, they're just trying to get by and feed their family and take care of their family. And they do have love for their country. But I think for them, too, it's hard to fathom a strong central government when possibly, like, I think you would have to see the country, but it's rugged. It's austere. It's not like here where you want to drive from Florida to California, you just hop on I-10 and it goes all the way across, and it's, you know, you can get there in a couple of days. There, it's going to take you a while. It's rough. I mean, you know, some of the living conditions, you know, in our standards, it's out there. I mean, it's tough. It's tough living. So, like I said, where I was, it's out there. There's not a whole lot. And that farmer, he's just trying to get by. He's trying to feed his family and take care of his kids and protect his little area. And, you know, we're not always there. So he just wants to get by and have some security. And, you know, there are bad guys out there and, you know, they are enemy. But I think for the average person, and maybe I'll find the best in people, but there are some good folks there. And they're good Afghans that we worked with, too, you know, our ALP. And they were good guys, or our ASG, I should have, not ALP, our Afghans here. Like, I mean, there's some good people. I mean, there really are some good, hardworking people who, you know, I trusted dearly. There are some that you don't necessarily trust.
I know Mark really liked at least one of the interpreters, Steve Dave. Did you know him?
Steve Dave, good guy. My guy was Hamza, was mine. Trying to think of our ASG leader. I mean, he was with my team. I mean, he was a genuinely good guy, you know. And, you know, there's a lot of good. I mean, it's, again, that was my perception. I mean, there are plenty of bad guys, and you try to differentiate between the two. And, you know, that's the tough part of analyzing what everybody's motivation are and who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. And it's hard when the bad guy is blending into the population. It gets tough sometimes.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, let's talk about your, I believe it happened in August of 2010, the big injury. Tell us about that day, and maybe if you knew that it was going to be rough going into that day, and, you know, and then what happened?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, we were just trying to, what the Taliban had kind of choked off the area to any supplies. I mean, the people didn't have wheat, you know, flour, all the stuff they need to make bread and do their daily staples. You know, there was no access to that. And we were trying to think how we could make it better for them, at least maybe if we could open up the route back into the village. Like at that point in time, for there was no ground route to a village down to the south in Deir Raoud. And we were going to do some missions combined with Captain Wilson or Major Wilson's team and mine, open up that ground route. And the first stop was a village that we knew was rough. It's, you know, every team that had been in there came under heavy contact. So we knew it was going to be a rough day. We were trying to do a key leader engagement in the village and kind of do some discussions, but we knew it was going to be a rough day. So we had all the air support and stuff laid on. And we had to do a river crossing. It's a tough place to get to. It sits in a peninsula and it has some mountains in the back of it. And there's some, you know, reports of anti-aircraft guns in the area. So we decided to do a ground infill. You know, we're going through some, and they would have had plenty of warning ahead of time because you got to go over a mountain pass to get in there, and it's just going to take a while. And we had to go through another village that isn't quite so friendly. And we got stopped on the route in by there was an IED in the route that we discovered, and we had to reduce that. And the UAVs that were on station saw all the women and children leaving along with animals. So that's all generally a bad sign. and you could hear the pop shots and that kind of stuff. Nothing very accurate while we reduced the IED. As we approached the village, you know, my team split up and my team went to the north side. And again, we were just trying to do a key leader engagement. And, you know, as we started, you know, the dog team and the EOD guys were clearing. My section went to the north. My team sergeant section went to the hill on the south side. And Major Wilson's team was going to a village called Resham, just to the south of the village of Garmab, where we were going. And the EOD team, along with the dog team, were clearing a route up the hill. And they, you know, we started coming under heavy fire. And I jumped up my, you know, jumped out of my Humvee and run to the top, and we're shooting back and trying to assess where the fire was coming from. And, you know, we're shooting back and looking, trying to assess the situation. And my team chief, Lance Allard, comes running up, you know, come up the hill, and we're talking, and he's like, "Hey, I'm going to get on the net and call the subs so we can start, you know, dropping or start trying to use our close air support." And when he did that, I said, "No, I got it." You know, as a team leader, that's my responsibility, not his. And I took off to run back down to the hill to get to back down to my vehicle, because they're still coming up. I mean, they were just trying to clear the route up so the Humvees can get up safely to get some good observation. And a few steps into it, boom. At the time, I thought it was a mortar is what I thought it was. And it's like, man, that's a lucky shot. And at the time, I didn't know what had happened. I was trying to, you know, I was a little dazed. I never lost consciousness, but I was dazed and really trying to get my wits about me. And I thought it was a mortar round. I was like, dang, that was just lucky. Like, I didn't know what happened. And I just remember having a mouthful of dirt and a bunch of loose teeth. And, you know, I was like, dang, my mom's going to kill me. She spent a lot on braces as a kid growing up. So, you know, eventually the dust cleared, and it was evident that it was bad. My left leg was gone above the knee, and my right leg was, my foot looked like, I told people it looked like just goo. I mean, the boot was there, but it wasn't a lot left in it. And I mean, I don't mean to gross anybody out. It's just what it looked like. And I mean, it's pretty shocking. You know, I yelled for the medic, and, you know, I tell people it's probably the most surreal, desperate feeling that anybody can have, because you don't know what to do. Like, you're in shock. I yelled for the medic, and I was calling, you know, screaming for the medic, but it wasn't like where you're just like screaming uncontrollably or something like that. I think it was just the shock of it, the surrealness. But it was just a weird feeling. Hold on, gotta get something to drink. It's just surreal. Like, you just can't believe it's happening. Like, no, I don't think any soldier out there, you know, never thinks about what if. It's kind of, if you start thinking of that, you know, chances are you can't kind of lose that edge. I don't know. Sounds cheesy, but you just can't let that enter your mind. And most people don't. Nobody thinks it's going to be them. And when it is, it's just kind of shocking. And got the medic, and you know, my team chief was also wounded. He took a bunch of shrapnel in the side, and three of our Afghan partners died. And
was that all from the same IED?
Yeah.
And was this an area you had already ridden over in the vehicles, and you're just going back down?
Not the vehicles hadn't made it up to that point. We had been around it on foot. I'd been past it, and I was just going back down the same way. Trying to get back to my vehicle. It's kind of, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a booby trap, and Well, unfortunately, that was just my luck of the draw that day. Just kind of, you know, it's once, you know, I tell, you know, people, like, I don't really think about that. You could what if it all day long, but it's just kind of, unfortunately, it happened. It was just my time. You know, as many hairy situations I've been, it just kind of just luck of the draw on that day. I got hit, and I had four guys. They jumped on me and put the tourniquets on the legs, and two guys kept pressure, like in the groin area, trying to just keep the pressure and keep the slow the bleeding down. And controller that was with me, George Earhart, he would have been right beside me had he not dropped his map. And I had taken off to start running, and he would have been right beside me. So that's kind of back to saying, like, luck of the draw. It's just kind of crazy how that happens. Like, he dropped his map, or otherwise he would have been right beside me. But they jumped on me, put the tourniquets on, you know, trying to talk to me and just trying to reassure me that everything's going to be all right. And it's kind of like you just want to beg for your life, but there's nobody to beg to. There's only but so much that they can do. And it's not like, you know, the forward surgical team is a ways away, and, you know, it's going to take a while for the medevac to get there. So those guys got to keep you alive and keep you alert. And they put the tourniquets on, and we're talking, and they're trying to get the situation under, but we're still under heavy fire at this point. I mean, they eventually got the Humvee up to shield us, but I mean, the guns are rocking, the battle's still going on. I mean, there's, you know, we started using the air support at one point, and I mean, Major Wilson's team was in heavy contact down in Reshnam. I mean, it was a It got real bad real fast. And long story short, I mean, I asked them, and I just told them to tell my family I'd be all right, you know, up or anything like that. But I didn't think I was going to make it off there. I made my peace, and I asked them to tell my family that I was going to be all right, and that I was okay, you know, and I was okay with it. It wasn't like, it's surreal, but I just asked them to tell my family I was okay. Like, that's what I just, that I did good, and that I was okay, and that, you know, it was all right. And they told me, don't talk like that. You're going to be all right. Just keep, you know, stay with them, keep fighting. And I said, I know. I just tell them. And they're like, hey, don't quit talking like that. You're going to be all right. And just stay positive. And I tried to, you know, we talked for a while. And by that point, you know, I lost a lot of blood. And, you know, I had a little bit of morphine by that point, and a fentanyl lollipop, just trying to, you know, keep my wits about me. Still pretty dazed. And as time goes on, you start to feel it more and more. Like, as the pain starts to get, you know, more and more intense, obviously, once, as the shock is kind of wearing off. But I also try to take a deep breath when it first happened. Just don't freak out. Just don't freak out, because you go into shock. They're not, you know, there's nothing they can do, because it can't stop the bleeding. It's just, so I really try to make a conscious effort not to freak out. I got tired at some point, and I asked them, like, hey, look, I'm tired. I just want to go to sleep. And they're like, no. You got to stay with us. Got to stay awake. Talk to me. And I was like, nah, man, I'm tired. I just want to take a short nap. I'll be here, but I'm tired. And I started to doze off, and they slapped me pretty good. And
on the medevac now?
Yeah, this is before. Like, I mean, the medevac took quite some time to get there. It was it's midday. I mean, it's pretty hot by this point, and we're up there, so it's really hard to get the helicopters up. You know, it takes time to get them spun up, and you're up at elevation. And also, I mean, it's you know, you got two ODAs in heavy contact at this time. And, you know, it's a lot going on, so it took a while. And, you know, same thing. They slapped me, and I was like, man, what are you doing? You know, and I was like, you know, I just want to go to sleep. Just let me go to sleep. And I started doze off again. They slapped me again, and I was like, you know, they're like, I'll make you a deal. We'll stop slapping you if you stay with us. And I was like, all right, you know, and, you know, I tried to really fight and stay with, and as time goes on, you get more and more agitated. You know, it's just, where's the medevac? Where's the medevac? And you just want to see the medevac. And, you know, I ripped my IV out, and started to be a pain in the butt for those guys. Cause like I said, just getting agitated, you're getting a little dazed and, you know, but I'm trying to fight, and the guys are talking to me about, you know, my kids and, you know, my son. I think every dad loves all their kids equally, but there's something, you know, for a father and a son. You know, my son is a fourth. I love all my kids equally, but my boy is my boy. And we talked about my boy and just baseball. I'm a baseball fanatic. Obviously, I played in college, so I have a lot of love for the game. And, you know, I try to stay alert, and in the distance, you know, the medevac is finally, I'll tell people, like, I didn't think I had a chance to make it until I saw that helicopter come over the horizon. They're like, you know, they're keeping me updated, and they're just trying to keep you going. And, you know, I'm laying on the stretcher on the ground there, and they're working. They're still trying to keep pressure, and the firefight's still going on. And Josh Christie, who's our EOD guy, he had cleared a route down the hill. I mean, it's a pretty good size hill. It's not like a tiny hill. He cleared a route down the hill for the Humvee to drive me down. And they loaded me up on the hood of the Humvee, and the gunner is still shooting, and the guys are talking to me. And I tell people, I didn't have a chance to, I just, the not relief, but it's like, man, I got a shot, you know, seeing that helicopter come over the horizon. And it's like, I have a chance. Like, I can't, like, it's somebody threw you a bone, and like, just hold on a little longer, just a little longer. And, they loaded me up on the hood of the Humvee after Josh had cleared the route down. And I didn't know it at the time, but I had a pretty good burn on my bottom. And the heat from the engine was just burning me. And I was begging them to take, but they couldn't take me off because it was the way down. And, you know, it was just a lot going on there. Like I said, it was a heavy contact. It just, things went bad. And, we got down to the hill, and they loaded me up on the Blackhawk. And, you know, my other medic had been shot the week prior, a couple weeks prior. So we were down to one medic, and they loaded me up. And my medic had told the guys on the helicopter that if they didn't get me there soon, that I wasn't going to make it. I had a few minutes and didn't have long. And so those guys, and on that helicopter crew, maxed that helicopter out. And I mean, they flew that thing past the limits that they were supposed to. So much that, I mean, from what I've been told, I mean, it broke. I got a piece of the helicopter that broke when they landed. And they had given it to my group commander, and I still have it to this day. And asked the group commander to get, he went back over there later on. And they gave it to him and asked him to give it to me and let me know how hard they flew to keep me alive.
Hmm. Wow. So what was the diagnosis? And then at least tell us a little bit about the recovery.
So, I mean, some of it I know from the doc. I had an opportunity to meet one of the surgeons that worked on me in Kandahar. He's an anesthesiologist who was he's a Navy Reserve physician, and I've had a chance to read. He had a journal that he let me read. It's not with my name on it, but it wasn't just about me. That was his way of coping with, you know, his own, you know, I think the people in the medical field have it rough, you know, during those times. They see the carnage, not necessarily the good. They've spent, you know, trying to put broken bodies back together, and keep people alive, and it was tough. And he was telling me that's one of the things that he did. So I had the opportunity to, you know, that was one of the ways he dealt with everything that he was going through. But long story short, I got to read it. And I know what people told me over time, and I took about 60 liters of blood transfusion in 2 days. I was in Kandahar completely unstable and unable to or just couldn't get back to the States at that point. I was a bilateral. Well, at that time I was above the knee on my left. My right knee was gone, or my right leg was about mid chin, maybe slightly above the ankle was gone. And I mean, I knew that was gone. what else? Not really anything internal. I mean, there were some burns. I had my broken hand. I had broken my femur. Where the femur connects into my hip was broken. There's a lot to deal with. But to caveat that, I didn't, you know, once I got on the medevac helicopter and made it back, I was kind of, they gave me a little more morphine on the helicopter. They could better monitor my vitals, so they gave me more morphine. My guys on the ground couldn't do it because my vitals were so low that they wouldn't have been able to monitor them proper, you know, they wouldn't have been able to make proper assessments is what my medic did. And so they gave me, well, I was pretty much in and out of consciousness once I got on the helicopters, you know, definitely out of it. And I remember bits and pieces, and some of it was more, some of it's hallucinations, but I really didn't come to until I was in San Antonio. And I still, I was heavily sedated and under a lot of medication initially. And then I really was not lucid or knew what was truly happening or going on until I was arrived in San Antonio, Texas, September 3rd of 2010. And I was originally wounded on August 28th. So about a week's time before I made it back to the States, roughly. And very heavily sedated and, you know, medicated up. So I didn't really know what was going on. And once they finally intubated me, and I tell people, like, initially, again, you know, still kind of out of it, very hallucinating a lot. And I kind of came to when I was coming out of surgery to take the bottom 6 inches of my femur. And that was kind of painful. And I also, they were unable to fix my hip where the femur was. So that was fairly painful anytime I was getting moved around, because that, you know, obviously your bone's broken and it's all moving around in there. That definitely doesn't feel good. And I had a bunch of burns that had to be grafted up, and there was just a lot going on. And our my ICU nurse, a lady named Charlotte Knight, and she was a major in the Air Force, I think, at that point. And I started to get more of my wits about me, and I was just having a pity party in the ICU, and she was getting on me about being active. And I was like, are you kidding me? I just got blown up a week ago. And she was forcing me to do this hand bike and do all this stuff. And she brought, like, made them bring me like a pull up bar and into my ICU room, and like not a big bar, but there was like a handle on my bed that, you know, she made, like, just getting on me about being active and staying with it. And like I said, I had a pity party for a little bit, but I mean, kind of just had to move on, you know. It stinks. I mean, so much of my life has been, you know, I've always been a good athlete. I was physically, I don't want to say gifted, it's kind of a, you know, but it was just, I was pretty talented physically and a lot of things. And I took pride in that. I loved that about it. You know, I look forward to teaching my kids how to be, you know, being athletic, and teaching my boy how to pitch a ball and all that stuff. And I can still do that now, but you know what I mean? Just showing them detail. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just that kind of thing. So it's just, it's an adjustment. But at the same time, and the conclusion that I finally came to is I was just grateful to be alive. Like, to go from thinking, like, 1 second, like, there's no way you're going to make it. Like, I'm never, you know, going to be able to, I'm not going to be on this earth anymore, to, okay, I'm alive, but life's different. And then you kind of initially you're like, man, I'm going to have to, you think, oh man, you know, I'm going to have to be taken care of for the rest of my life. And, you know, you're going to have to be in some, you know, nothing, but I mean, you're going to have somebody driving you around in a van and people, you know, I'm not going to be able to feed myself and all that stuff. And you're just going to have to be taken care of and you're going to be a burden on people. And then slowly but surely, a good thing that they do at Brook Army Medical Center was they would send guys over to kind of talk to you, maybe guys with similar injuries that have been through what you've been through. And you kind of, you know, you see that, you talk to, oh yeah, man, I drive and I'm out and, you know, I go do everything on my own and I don't need, you know, you see that there's still a life, you know, you still have a life regardless of what your injuries are. I mean, there, you know, there are some injuries obviously that are fairly significant and, you know, those people unfortunately aren't able to take care of themselves, but just because I lost two legs doesn't mean there's not a whole, you know, you find out that there's a lot you can still do and you can still be active and still do physical things. I think eventually just came to the conclusion that I could still have a life. There's still a lot I can do. There's an adjustment. You know, I tell people life is different. It is different, you know, but I can still be active and still do stuff. I still, you know, I was given an opportunity to still be there with my kids, and not everybody's that lucky. And I think I felt I'd be doing them a disservice if I sat around and pouted about the second chance I was given. I was given a second chance for a reason, and that's a blessing. I tell people it's like hitting the lotto, but just for a second chance at life. It's worth more than any amount of money in the world. And, you know, I think about, like I said, those seven soldiers that, you know, that were my platoon. And I mean, those aren't, I've had countless friends that aren't here anymore, but just young guys who aren't here. And some of those were fathers and husbands and so on. They're just sons, you know, if I didn't just keep living my life, I'd be doing them a disservice, and also my kids and everybody else. So I just kind of had to just accept it and just move on, you know, not move on. It's never, you know, it's never easy. I don't, you know, there are times where you think about it, and I miss it, and I miss just doing certain things where I was like, man, I wish I could even go for, you know, go out and go for a long run and de-stress. Or even for me, like, it's kind of funny, but I mean, I love riding roller coasters and can't do that anymore. So there's times, and, you know, that's just a couple of examples on things you wish you could do. But, you know, but in general, I was given a second chance, and I love life, and I know what it's like to almost have it snatched away from you. And don't get me wrong, I'm not bitter about it by any means. It's not bitter. I learned some life lessons in doing that. Just, you know, looking at adversity, it's probably not a lot of people have been through adversity like that, and taught me how to deal with it and just being able to move on. You know, it wasn't always easy. I mean, there were things that, you know, you kind of asked about my family earlier. I'm going through my thing, and I picked up and, you know, not easily, don't get me wrong, you get some nudging, but after a while you just, you know, I just jumped into it, the rehab and everything else, and just trying to get better. And I'm going to walk. And at first I said, man, I'm going to go back to SF, and I'm going to go back and be a team leader. And, you know, that's something I'm going to be the guy to do it, you know. And I think you know, it's hard to at first to kind of understand that you're a little physically different, physically limited slightly. I mean, I came to the conclusion that I couldn't lead in the manner that I wanted to lead. And I mean, that's a tough pill to swallow. But initially, that's what I thought. Man, I'm going to go back and do it. I mean, there are guys that do it. And I mean, but it's just hard to do as a bilateral amputee above knee. And I mean, there are guys that stayed in the Army and went back to group. But at the same time, I knew I wouldn't be doing what I wanted to do. So I think that was kind of one of the tougher decisions. But I jumped full on into rehab and kind of, you know, going to the gym twice a day and just, you know, like everything else, you just got to jump into it, you know. But part of like the walking and stuff, it took me a while. I had a lot of skin problems over time, a lot of skin issues and, you know, failed skin grafts a few times and had to use experimental skin that eventually worked out. But then eventually that broke down and they had to take all the skin and tissue off my lat and my back and graft that on my leg. And I mean, that was a whole different animal there. And I mean, there are setbacks. You're going to get setbacks and, you know, you'd be one in a million if you don't have any setbacks and you're just able to jump right in without any issues or things going on that, you know, it's just being able to, okay, I mean, it is what it is. You can't really control it per se. But what I was saying earlier was something that I missed, and not everybody takes it the same way you do, where you just, you know, part of growing up for me, my folks were always just like, hey man, if this goes wrong, what are you going to do? And I kind of took that attitude. It's like, I mean, it happened. All right, let's move on. Just jump right into rehab and just kind of forget everything else. And I didn't see how my kids are struggling with what happened and how initially it was tough for them to see me in the ICU. And I was, you know, they didn't take it so well. It's like, boom, like, you know, a month, 2 months later, they're packed up and they're living in San Antonio, Texas out of a suitcase. You know, and they jumped a new school and it wasn't planned, you know, in the military, like, you know, normally, you know, a little ways out, like you're getting ready to move and the kids can kind of wrap their brain around it. And, you know, dad's been this, you know, patriarch of the family and leading the way and just about it, you know, I took care of everything. And, them, it was just a change. You know, I felt bad, and I'll be honest with you, and one of the things that I regret is I was unable to see that. I was so engulfed in just getting back to walking again and doing other things that I missed it. I didn't see how they were struggling. And, you know, my youngest was one, so she didn't know any better. And she don't really remember anything without me, you know, me without having legs. Like, she can't imagine that. The rest of the kids can't. I mean, my boy, he was, I think, 4 at the time. You know, that's all he knows. I mean, that's, you know, he's a boy, so he kind of, he's whatever. But my two girls, they took it, my oldest girls, they took it real hard. And I didn't see it. And, you know,
I think that's something that none of us can, or a lot of people probably don't even think of when they think of someone getting injured. I mean, the strain on the family, I think, is tough enough just for deployments and what you deal with, maybe psychologically from maybe certain situations being deployed. But then with this, I mean, I appreciate you sharing that, and you can continue if you want, but I think this is good for people to understand what it can do to relationships and to families. I know you got divorced sometime in that period.
Yep. It was a couple years afterwards. You know, perfectly. I mean, it was already strained before that at times. I mean, the military, at least at that point, between deployments and training and everything else, I mean, over a 4-year period, I'd live with my family 6 months. Between 2 deployments to Iraq, and it's just kind of how it laid out for me. And then I started the Q course, and you're gone for that, and then you deploy to Afghanistan. And I mean, it's just a tough family life at that point in time. I mean, maybe things are slowing down now as at that point in time. And, you know, for me, I also got married young, and there's other things that goes into it, but it's definitely not easy. And it's a strain on that as well, because you're just like, you expect everybody else to deal with it the same way you've dealt with it. And that's not the case. Not everybody sees the world the same way. And I mean, I'm no saint or not perfect, you know, by any means. And I just didn't see what everybody else was going through. I just expect everybody to pick up and suck it up like I did. And, you know, not to say that I don't ever have bad days or I don't, you know, there was initially, I remember, I think it was Thanksgiving, and I don't think I've ever told anybody that before, but I just cried most of the day because it was the first Thanksgiving, and I think I just got out of the hospital or I'd come home to have dinner, or, you know, my family was living in an apartment, and I cried most of the day just because why me? You know, like, there are plenty of other good folks out there that probably deserve to be there more than I did, but I don't think I've ever, you know, even my wife, she's probably ticked off right now because I haven't told her that story, but I just bawled most of the day because it's tough. I won't say survival's guilt, but just overwhelmed is the way I'll put it. It's a lot to take in, you know.
I can only imagine. Will, we've run up on, we've been talking for a while, and it's been, I've really loved it. There's actually a lot of things I'd love to dig in with you. Maybe we can do it again, because I'd like to talk about maybe the role the Army played in just helping you and recover, and or if they did. You know, I know that talking to other people in Air Force Special Tactics, you know, they've been very involved. The Air Force has helped them out a lot. So I'd be curious to see from the Army standpoint. And I guess, but really, probably just need to wrap it up. And
okay.
But would you mind just maybe what advice have you given people? Either maybe were you one of the ones who later on went into the hospital and met with people? And then what advice did you give them, and maybe to other people now going through adversity?
I always went back whenever I was asked. I was one of those people to go over and meet with people, and that's kind of how I met Johnny Yellock, who's a friend of yours and a friend of your family's, and he was a friend of Mark's. And they were really good friends going, and I didn't know him at the time, but when he got wounded, you know, at least in the special ops and then just in the Army in general, but I'd say more in special ops, it's just a brotherhood and kind of, I think in the military in general, but more for guys who've been through some kind of specialized training where anybody for the SOCOM Care Coalition with the Army is what they call it. And any special operations guy, we make it a point to just go over there and go meet with them and see what their needs are. If you can encourage them and be there and kind of show them the ropes and kind of just say, hey, look, like life is going to be different. I mean, that's the truth. If you're missing a couple limbs, or maybe you're not missing a limb, maybe they're just busted up real bad, or, you know, you've been through a traumatic experience and life is different, but there's almost nothing that you can't do that you weren't doing before. It may be in a different manner. You can figure it out. And it's, you know, a lot of what I've done and been through is just figuring out what works. And you can get out there. I mean, last January, I went snowboarding with my wife out in Montana. Never been snowboarding in my life, but I went snowboarding. I never hunted before I was injured. I've jumped out, you know, I've been elk hunting in Wyoming. I've been, you know, people are so gracious and they'll do so many things. I'm just so humbled. And, you know, people like yourself, your brother Joseph, who I met in San Antonio at a soccer game, just in random. He's like, hey, you know, I know you. I was still intubated and out of it the first time I ever met him. But just the kindness of people, like, people are going to be there for you. And they're there to help you out and just take advantage of it, and just be grateful that you got. I mean, I don't know personal circumstances, but you can deal with. Just take it. Just talk to people. People will listen to you. Just be grateful. I'm so grateful and so humbled and so honored. People have been there for me, but there's almost nothing that I can't do I mean, if you just want to set your mind to it, you can do it. It's possible. You know, I swim. I don't know what else to say. Just enjoy life. Be grateful for life. And people will be there for you. I'm here to help you. My door is, I tell people all the time, I give, you know, my number. I'll talk to you. I'm there for you. Other people are there for you. Just be positive. Be grateful, whatever it is. I mean, I'm grateful for every last second I got on this earth. And that's one lesson I've learned, is just stay positive and set your mind to it. You can do it. And whatever that is, whatever you want to do, where there's a will, there's a way. And that sounds so cheesy and cliche, but it is 100% the truth. I mean, if you want it, you can do it. And I don't know what your disability is or what you're going through mentally or anything, but if you're just positive and you want to do it, go out and do it. You can do it. I've seen people that are struggling, people with injuries way worse than mine, that just get out and they want to do something, they're going to do it, and they put their mind to it and they get after it. And that's what you got to do. And that's kind of what I have to do. You know, my wife puts up with a lot. and it's like, I'm the good idea guy. Just jump out there and go do it. You know, and she's like, oh my goodness, like, what are you doing? And, you know, it's just take advantage of it. Somebody's going to be there and life will pick you up and people will be there to pick you up. Just have faith. And I'm just so blessed and so humbled. And if I can inspire the next guy to be like that, or encourage them in some way, shape, or form, you know, and help them. It's just like, don't be afraid. People are there to listen to you. And, you know, and if if religion is part of your life, I mean, the Lord's there to listen to you. Give it to him, and he'll shoulder it. He'll help you out, and he'll maybe put some other people in your life to help you out. Just talk to people. Don't be afraid.
Well, the Lord is really the only one who knows exactly how you feel. Other people could know pretty close that may have been through the same situation, but he's the only one that really knows. I'm curious, how tall are you now? Did you lose some inches?
No, I went back to, I'm back to 6'3". I thought that was important. I've never been a little guy, and I wasn't going to be a little guy. and plus, I think it would look mismatched if I was a little guy. When I put my legs on, I'm definitely as tall as I used to be. Maybe slightly shorter, but pretty much at my regular height. They try to keep people below 6 feet or right at about 6 feet, but I was pretty adamant that I go back to the same height. I am the same height. That does make it harder to walk and balance and that kind of thing. So it just, walking's not easy. It's, you know, that was my choice though. I didn't want to be short. And so that's but when you fall, you fall a little further when you're 6'3" versus 6 foot, or there's, you know, but when I snowboard, I'm 5'2". So, got a different set of legs for that. So.
Okay. That makes a little more sense. I was just visualizing that. It's like, wow, that's incredible. It still is incredible that you did that. Skiing, I've never snowboarded, but skiing is one of those sports where I feel so helpless. I mean, I've always been athletically inclined, and I ski now. But wow, I feel more helpless doing that than I do any other sport.
Oh, so do I. It was kind of I went out to Whitefish, Montana, and they have a good veteran support team out there, and they put on an event. I think it's they have one in this winter and one in the summer, and just a phenomenal group out there, retirees, and actually. There's a general who has a house out there, and he's actually special operations, and he did a lot of work with Ranger Regiment and JSOC, and he's part of the team out there, and they're just a good group of folks, and they have, you know, set up so nice, and they're just a giving community, and just the vets put it on. It's actually a large, pretty good-sized veteran community out there, and it's just a good, and it's no – you know, it's no dog and pony show. There's no, you know, and nothing against that. I mean, but there's,
you know, cameras and
no cameras, nothing like they. I mean, they do stuff, but they, you know, it's hard to explain. I mean, some stuff you do, and it ends up to be a lot of cameras, and you know, I'm not knocking any of that, but sometimes it's tough, you know, to yeah. You just want to go out and have a good time, and sometimes you know, some of these events. You know, it's a blessing. I'm not knocking it, but sometimes it's tough when this camera's always in your face. And this event, there's no cameras. You're just out there, and they take pictures for their thing. They have a little small newsletter for their people that support their group. But, you know, Team Red, White, and Blue is a part of that. And they do, you know, it's just a good thing. And you get out there but it's just you. If you don't want to do stuff, you don't have to do stuff with the group. And they let, you know, my wife went with me and she got out there. She snowboarded growing up, so she was a lot better at it than I was. So it was just an opportunity for us to kind of get away and kind of get away from the grind and kind of for me to get a new experience. But I had a one-on-one instructor out there the whole time, and he was good. And it was a good experience, and again, it's one of those things where you figure out what works for you and what doesn't, and you just figure out a way to do it. And I won't say I was like I'm not going to be on X Games or something like that, but it was fun. I can't wait to get out. I'm hoping to get out again this winter and do it, you know, try to make it a yearly thing when I can, and maybe even take my little ones out there and do, you know, get that experience with mm-hmm. them, something that I can do, and kind of we'd be on mutual turf per se, both like a newborn giraffe or something. We'll all be like that. So,
well, it's been inspiring, Will. I really appreciate you spending time with us. And I really thank you so sincerely for serving our country and for being willing to sacrifice yourself and for what you've gone through and continue to go through. I know my brother Mark thought a lot of you, and he told Joseph, my brother Joseph, about that you were hurt and to please go see you, because he lived in San Antonio at the time, and you know, yep. You made mention of that earlier, but I don't know, just it's just many of us will never know what it's like to live through war, to live through an experience like that. But it's just what you have overcome and are overcoming is so applicable to just about to everybody, really. And so appreciate your motivating words and attitude. And I hate that we have to really cut it off, but I mean, because there's so much we could really, I think, get into, and you could talk more about your mindset and number of surgeries and, I don't know, all kinds of things, but you've overcome, and I'm sure it's a continuous struggle, and I'm glad you've got a good wife there to help you out, and of course your kids to motivate you too, and there's no doubt you're motivating them. What's the best way for people, listeners, to find out about you, or maybe even to see a picture of you, you know, to get a visual of your legs? Is it just Google you, or is there a specific website?
I mean, you could, I don't really have a website or anything. I mean, if you want to talk to me, I mean, feel free to reach out to me at william.lyles3@gmail.com, or I'm on LinkedIn. I think that might be under William Lyles, but might be under Will Lyles. I'm not sure. I'll have to get back to you on that. And I mean, if you Google me, Captain Will Lyles, probably you can see a few things on there. Might be a video of a speech that I gave. Went back to VMI and gave a speech to cadet athletes and their family and scholarship recipients. The annual fall banquet they have at VMI, and you could see a little video of that speech and kind of read a little bit more about me. So I mean, it's a few years old, but I don't. Honestly, I'm not a big deal, and I'm just lucky to be here talking to you. I'm very fortunate. Just I gave more, or the Army gave to me more than I gave to it. So if I can reach out and do anything for you, please feel free to do that. And maybe I should come up with a website or something, but I don't think I'm that big of a deal. I just have a story to tell, and I hope to inspire people to keep striving no matter what struggles you're going through. I grew up in the Army, and I'm just fortunate. I'm so fortunate through those experiences of being wounded, and I just want to pay it forward. I think life is about paying it forward and making it better for my children and for everybody else out there, and just leaving the world better, or leaving the world in a better position than it was when I came into it. So I've had some awesome experiences, and I just want to give back. I think I'm fortunate, and I think that's my mission. And it's given a second chance at life, and I just want to keep giving others as much as I've gotten in return after being just in general, but after being injured, I'm so thankful and so grateful.
Well, I appreciate it. You're definitely a patriot to the core, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Sorry if I went a little long-winded on you. I guess I got a lot to say, so I apologize if I went too long.
That's no problem. It was great.